KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in this week for Michael Krasny. Coming up, he was an outspoken skeptic of climate change. But now UC Berkeley physics professor Richard Muller says he believes not only that climate change is real, but that it's almost entirely caused by human behavior. He'll join us for the hour to discuss his evolution and why he remains unconvinced that global warming is responsible for recent extreme weather. But that point of view is contradicted by a new study released Tuesday outlining climate-related threats to California. We'll talk about all of that this hour, and we'll get started with Forum right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. Over the past few years, UC Berkeley physics professor Richard Muller has made a name for himself as an outspoken critic of climate change science and as author of the book Physics for Future Presidents. But in a much-talked-about New York Times op-ed this week, Muller announced he's revised his thinking on climate change, concluding that not only is global warming real, but that almost all of it is caused by human behavior. Professor Muller joins us now. Good to have you with us.
Delighted to be here.
And also with us, Craig Miller. He's senior editor of KQED's Climate Watch, and he's here to talk with us about a couple of new reports on climate change in California. And Craig, I want to begin with you. Mm-hmm. One of those two reports is titled California's Changing Climate. It was funded by the California Energy Commission. Give us some of the highlights.
And just to set the stage for you, Scott, this is a series of ongoing reports, the assessments, they call them, that the state's doing. Did the first one in 2006, and then this is the third one that's come out. Each time they get a little more specific about projections and a little more regional, you know, in their character. If you picture a photograph, when you blow it up, it gets blurry, right? This has been the problem with the global climate models now. But now they're developing models, you know, where they can actually sharpen the focus a little bit, depending on where you live, which is what planners are asking for. It's like, you know, we want to know what's going to be going on.
Some more,
in our
more
town.
Useful information.
Yeah. But if you average everything out, basically, a lot of people talk about what's happening at the end of the century, but let me give you a snapshot from this report of 2050, which is like less than 40 years away at this point. Another 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. That would be three times, according to this report, the rate of warming from the last century.
And that means what exactly? You're talking about
average temperature.
Average temperatures
California's
for
average
California.
Temperature. That's right.
Okay.
That's what most of these are reflected as
okay.
averages. A pronounced shift to drier conditions by mid-century. 10 to 18 inches of additional sea level rise. Now, if you have 16 inches of additional sea level rise, one report shows that a couple of dozen fire and emergency response stations in San Francisco would be virtually inaccessible during storms. And a 100-year storm, what we now consider a 100-year storm, could occur once a year. So there's a lot of stuff going on here, a lot of stuff mixed in. But if you're sitting, let's say, here's why it's important for planners. You know, if you're sitting, let's say, in Sacramento running SMUD, the electrical utility there, you want to know, well, what does that mean for me? Now they're able to make projections like, well, it could mean days on which the temperature reaches 105 degrees in Sacramento, which happens maybe four or five times a year now, could happen 20 times a year by 2050. And so you're already adding up the new air conditioners if you're that guy at the utility and wondering what you're going to do about
that. But hasn't been increasing over the last decade or so, hasn't it?
Things have generally been getting warmer, yes.
You're saying the rate of warming is going to go up?
What this report is saying is the rate of warming will accelerate. I'm sure Dr. Muller will have more to say about that. And now it's this kind of specificity for planners and decision makers that is new in this particular report.
And what does it mean for different parts of California? Are there parts of the state, for example, that in some ways might do better because of global warming? Are there any winners?
Well, certainly there's, the coastal regions of California are going to warm up a lot less. You know, the inland regions are going to take it on the chin. The Sierra are already taking it on the chin, according to this report. And if you look at the...
And what does that mean?
Well, they're warming faster.
So there's less snow.
There's less snow. There's more precipitation in the mountains these days falling as rain as opposed to snow. The runoff is occurring earlier. This is creating problems with the timing of the water that comes down that's needed for farms and cities throughout California during the dry summer. If it all comes down at once and runs off, you don't have as much in storage to use for the rest of the summer.
And there was a second report. Well, before we get to the second report, is there total consensus, would you say, among these, 120 or so scientists that put this together, that this is all due to climate change? This is a result of human behavior.
It depends on what piece you're talking about. Like, for example, if you look at the wildfire risk, there are a lot of factors that go into why we're seeing more wildfires, why we're seeing more severe wildfires. A lot of it has to do with just having more people in harm's way than we used to have. But definitely, I think there's a consensus that climate change is a factor here. The state's fire chief pointed out that of the 20 worst fires in California history, 11 of them have taken place since 2002. So they're looking at a trend like that, and they're fairly alarmed about that.
And I think we have a cut from, Ken Alex?
Yeah, Ken Alex runs the governor's Office of Planning and Research, and he kind of sums things up here. But also, and this was a kind of a thread that ran throughout the media briefing on this report when they held it yesterday, was that there's still this kind of sense of, it's not all hopeless.
Climate change is here now in California. We need to adapt, and we need to understand what that adaptation requires and what the vulnerabilities of particular communities are. We understand now that we have great threats, of fire that we've heard about, sea level rise, drought, flooding. These are a series of plagues, but we're not helpless.
And Craig Miller, what does that adaptation look like?
Well, it looks like a lot of different things. We're seeing it play out right here in San Francisco right now with something called the Ocean Beach Master Plan, which is a kind of test case for coastal communities all around the country, really. Adaptation is the wonky term, of course, there's a certain amount of climate change coming, a certain amount of warming and impacts. What are we going to do about it? So here's a plan to take, among other things, a major thoroughfare or part of it and move it significantly inland. This is the kind of radical, what the planners' term for this is managed retreat. The generals used to call it strategic withdrawal.
Sounds like Vietnam.
That's right. Okay, nature wins. We're just going to get out of the way. But that's a $300 million undertaking.
So a lot of development decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to bring Professor Muller in just a second, but that second report by Environment California looking more at precipitation over the last, 60 years or so?
Yeah, they went back 60 years, and Environment California is an advocacy group. This did not go through a formal peer review process, but it was looked over by some people at NOAA, National Climatic Data Center, and other places. And basically what it sees is diverging trends in California over the last several decades. And just looking at extreme precipitation events, the big storms, that they're getting more frequent and more extreme in Southern California, and the opposite is happening in Northern California. They're becoming less frequent and less severe.
And the implications of that for, say, water supply and water use?
Well, remember, these are extreme events that they're talking about. They're not so much looking at total precipitation. It doesn't completely invert the old, north has all the water scenario. What it does mean is that in Southern California, there's going to be big implications for emergency response, flooding and situations like that.
This maybe is a little bit out of left field, but last week, Governor Brown talked about a project to build basically a new peripheral canal to bypass the Delta. Are there any implications for that planning based on these reports?
Well, the Delta is a key part of this whole scenario, particularly when you're looking at the water needs of California's future. Basically, everybody, I think, is in agreement that we need a solution for the Delta, whether it's a couple of tunnels underground or some other approach. If the Delta doesn't get, quote, fixed, that's the switching yard for California's water all up and down the state. That will exacerbate the water problems if there's no solution.
Yeah. All right. That's Craig Miller, a senior editor of KQED's Climate Watch. And I want to bring in our other guest now, Professor Richard Muller from Berkeley. And before I ask you about that op-ed piece that you wrote this week, I want to ask you for your reaction to what Craig just said in these two reports on climate and the implications for climate from global warming.
Well, now that I'm more convinced that carbon dioxide is responsible, I think much in that report is indeed valid and cause for concern. Although from what we've done, The overall global changes are things now that I think we feel pretty confident about. I don't trust the climate models on looking at the microstructure and what's going to happen in northern and southern California. If we're spending $300 million to move a freeway because water is going to go up 16 inches, I'm not sure that's the best way to spend the money.
Why? Or what would...
Well, the big issue here is 16 inches isn't going to affect any highway. It should not. The big issue here and the reason that these projections are going up is simply that the emissions of carbon dioxide from China and India have continued to grow at a fantastic rate, one that was not anticipated a few years ago. People had thought their rate would slow down to 3-4, I think 4% is the official number of the Energy Information Agency. In fact, it's been up at 8% and 9%. So by the end of this year, China will be producing twice the carbon dioxide of the United States. So this is why the projections are getting somewhat on a shorter time scale than they had been. And if we're going to do anything about this, we're not going to do it in California. It has to be done in the developing world where most of that carbon dioxide will be coming from.
Yeah. Now, in that op-ed piece in the New York Times, and by the way, we have it at our website, kqed.org/forum, it seems that you not all of your skepticism about climate science has been abandoned, that you still feel that there is a lot of exaggeration, that some of the data is misused or misrepresented. And does that apply in particular to climate, some of the things we're hearing about weather, for example, and things that are getting attributed to global climate change?
Well, in our study, we found that fully one-third of the temperature stations in the United States have shown cooling over the last 100 years. Two-thirds have shown warming. Climate change so far has been less than 1 degree Celsius, and that's impossible for any individual to see. When I was young, everything that was seen in the weather was attributed to nuclear testing. Now, everything that's seen in the weather is attributed to climate change. Now, climate change has been tiny so far. No individual can see the effects. It takes scientists looking at large numbers of things. These things about wildfires, the number of wildfires has actually been going down in the U.S. The number of tornadoes has been going down. The number of hurricanes has been level or going down. So there's so much misinformation out there, usually done by people who are truly concerned about global warming and feel they need to alert the public by coming up with exaggerated scenarios. But I think that most of these exaggerated scenarios, when they're eventually shown to be false, and polar bears aren't dying because of climate change, then we lose the public. They don't like to be fooled. I think we need to be more honest with the public, and not exaggerate, not try to lead them to the right conclusion through exaggerations.
So what this news that your views on climate change have evolved, and rather than having me characterize what you wrote in that op-ed page piece, why don't you tell me how your views evolved and what prompted you to write this op-ed?
If you'd asked me 3 years ago about global warming, I would have said I'm agnostic, that issues had been raised criticizing the scientific work that had been done up to that point that led me to not be able to conclude that global warming was even real. And there's lots of cherry-picking data. You can see Europe has warmed, the harbors have cleared up, and so on, but that was local. And there were these criticisms, and they were valid criticisms, criticisms that the data had been selected. In one case, the UK group used only 7% of the available stations. There were urban heat island effects, which perhaps were not handled correctly. There were adjustments to the data that were done before publication, and there was no record of those adjustments. They couldn't even tell us what had been done. There was there were other biases too. The station quality was very poor. So based on these things, I couldn't sign a petition saying yes, I believe that climate science is in good shape. In fact, these were issues that had to be addressed, and since I couldn't find the answers for this, my daughter and I, in partnership, created a team we called Berkeley Earth that would do a scientific study consisting of about a dozen scientists, some of the best scientists in the world, including Art Rosenfeld, famous for his love for his innovative work in energy conservation, Saul Perlmutter, who 2 years later was to win the Nobel Prize, not for our work, but for something else. We put together this team and began a study. About a year ago, we had analyzed all of the data. We had avoided making hands-on corrections. We had studied all of these other issues and put together a record that now I could believe in, and it indeed did show global warming.
And global warming caused primarily now, you say, or believe, by humans.
That was just the work of the last 6 months. Robert Rohde, our young, absolutely outstanding scientist, was able, by using the best possible statistical methods, to extend the record back 250 years. That's extraordinary, 100 years more than anybody else had done. In that longer record, we could look for the signatures of the volcanic contributions. We could look for the signatures of the solar variability. We could look for everything. And we saw the volcanoes, but they only had short-termed contributions. The solar variation, essentially absent. The thing that fit it right on was the carbon dioxide. And that came to me as a shock. And at that point...
Why were you so shocked?
Well, it was such a good fit. In the literature, you find there are so many things that take place. And we could throw those in, and it makes the fit a little bit better. But by far, even going back 250 years, it was a good fit. This is a stronger conclusion than the UN organization, the IPCC, had concluded. They only said that most of the warming of the past 50 years was due to humans. Our data suggests to me that essentially all of the warming of the past 250 years is due to humans.
That's Richard Muller, a professor of physics and author of the new book, Energy for Future Presidents. He penned an op-ed piece this week in the New York Times, which was titled The Conversion of a Climate Change Skeptic. And Craig Miller, what's going on in the blogosphere around this conversion, this evolution, which is now what we say about policy changes or points of view that have evolved over the recent years or months?
I tend to think it's been a little bit overstated. There's Dr. Mueller's, quote, conversion, you know, has received a lot of press and has been kind of building ever since, you know, his first op-ed piece where he said, okay, it's warm. for the first time, because he had been sort of a high-profile skeptic, you know, over the years. Not the only one. There are other scientists like—
One of the more credible ones, perhaps.
Well, yeah, I mean, exactly. But there are other credible scientists like Roger Pelkey Jr. in Colorado, you know, who sort of consider themselves the conscience, you know, of the climate science movement and they like to point out the flaws when they're there. But there's a lot of entrenchment and polarization around this issue, and I don't see the people who are like really entrenched on at one end or the other really moving toward the middle on this or in either direction.
Yeah. But Dr. Miller?
Yeah, I wouldn't expect them to move. Science isn't based on respecting other people and then changing your mind because they do. If anybody says, well, if Mueller believes what I do, I lose a little bit of respect for them. The knee-jerk reaction, these papers have only been posted for a few days. We expect our influence to come from the work we did, not from my opinion. So there are five papers now online, and they're there. Our computer program is online. All of the data are online. We're setting a new standard, I think, for transparency and openness. And I would expect that if opinions are going to be changed, it will take weeks or months as people study this work and realize what I believe they will conclude, namely that we did a very good job addressing these issues.
You, in the past, Professor Mueller, have had some of your research funded by the Koch brothers, the Koch Foundation, who are well known to be affiliated with the Cato Foundation and trying to donate and influence the election, giving large sums of money to defeat Barack Obama. And I'm wondering, first of all, in that research that you did, was there any expectation, subtle, explicit, implicit, or otherwise, that the outcome was going to be a certain way or that you were being asked to do the research to get a particular outcome?
Absolutely none. We were told quite explicitly that they just wanted us to do good, objective science. No hint as to what they wanted. And if they had hinted, we probably wouldn't have taken the money.
Why do you think they chose you?
I think because we were aware of the valid issues raised by the skeptics. And not all of these were valid. There are people I call deniers that simply pay no attention to the science and they start with their conclusions. But there are also exaggerators who do the same thing on the other side, who say, oh, global warming is real. We're to blame, especially the United States. And then they adduce the science to it that helps support their point of view. But we understood both sides. And the thoughtful skeptics had raised issues that demanded explanation. We set out to do this. We didn't know whether we'd be able to come up with an answer. because some of these things, Anthony Watts's work, for example, showing of the poor station quality, if that held up, then there's not, then we would have no temperature records. Then the most, the key aspect of global warming would be without data. So that had to be looked at very carefully.
Yeah, and I'm curious, since you your new data and your op-ed piece this week came out, have you heard from the Koch brothers or anybody else sort of on the skeptics or denier, climate change denier spectrum of the of things?
Oh, I've been flooded with email.
what are they saying?
Well, many people somehow reacting to what our conclusions were rather than to what we did. And that doesn't surprise me. This is, there seems to be in the blog sphere an incentive to be rude. I think it gets you more readers or something like that, but not the kind of readers that I think we really want. From the thoughtful people, including some of our funding agencies, they're congratulating us on having achieved a goal that, quite frankly, a few years ago, we didn't know that we would be able to address the issue of the human cause. I had thought that solar variability would be a big component of this, and its utter absence comes to me as a surprise. But we've done it in a simple way. Our methods don't require huge global climate models with their hidden parameters and unknown assumptions to reach a conclusion. I think it's the simplicity, sort of the Occam's razor, if you will, the fact that our data is such a good match to carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that makes the results relatively compelling and easy to understand.
And Craig Miller, what do you think, as someone who studies this as a journalist, what do you think are the implications of the data, the op-ed, the conversion of this skeptic to someone who not only believes it's real, but the causes of it being largely human?
I think it will be very. In fact, there's a poll coming out later today, about Californians' attitudes, toward global warming and policy implications of that. And I suspect you'll find that kind of is kind of holding steady because it has over the years. I think what will be really interesting will be to see a nationwide poll toward the end of this epically hot summer, and see if attitudes have changed. Because like it or not, for good or for bad, I think people's attitudes toward climate change are heavily influenced by what's going on outside their window. It's kind of the tyranny of the present.
Yeah, Dr. Mullen.
Yeah, ironically, this has been the hottest year on record in the United States. Like, there's a lot of attention here. When I first heard that, I was surprised because I was looking at global records, and I had seen that, in fact, the last 12 months was actually somewhat cooler than it's been for a while globally. So I looked on the websites of the NASA, the NOAA, the UK groups, and indeed, even their records are showing that it's somewhat cooler worldwide in the last 12 months. It's just in the United States. This is what we used to call a heat wave.
I know, Craig.
But thousands of records were broken in the process of this heat wave, though.
I know you cautioned me, Craig, whenever we talk about this. Well, climate is not the same as weather.
Right.
Don't confuse the two.
Right. And yet people do confuse the two continually. They say climate is what you expect, weather is what you get. And in my hometown and your hometown of Buffalo, is like I say, if you don't like the weather, wait 20 minutes.
Or move.
Yeah, right.
That's what I did.
Because it's going to change. A single year, even 10 years running, is not a good indication of what the climate is doing.
All right. Craig Miller, senior editor of KQED's Climate Watch. He'll be here for the rest of the hour. Also, Richard Muller, a professor of physics at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the new book, Energy for Future Presidents. And we invite you to join the conversation. Questions for either Professor Muller or Craig about these new reports on California's climate and what it means for us going down the road to 2050. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. 866-733-6786 or email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, we're talking about climate change written about in an op-ed piece this week by our guest, Professor Richard Muller, a physicist at UC Berkeley, author of the new book, Energy for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. He's also founder of the Berkeley Earth Surface Temperature Project. And also with us here, Craig Miller, senior editor for KQED's Climate Watch. His blog can be found, by the way, at kqed.org/climatewatch. And he's here talking about a couple of new reports this week, out yesterday, in fact, about California's changing climate. And the number to call if you want to join our conversation with questions for either Mr. Mueller or Mr. Miller, it's the Miller and Mueller Show this hour, 866-733-6786, the number to call. And, of course, you can always send your comments to forum at kqed.org. We were talking during the break, something I want to bring up, which is California policy. We're thought of, Craig, as a leader, you know, on climate change and AB 32, the bill that Governor Schwarzenegger signed to reduce carbon emissions. Is that going to make a difference in any of this in terms of leadership nationally, globally?
Probably a good chance to point out that when they presented this study that came out yesterday, this third climate assessment for California, they did stress that the amount, the degree, no pun intended, of warming will depend on the pace of emissions, of greenhouse gas emissions, you know, it could be 2 degrees, it could be 8 degrees, you know. I mean, it's a big range of possibilities in there. Normally, when they present these projections, though, they look at the higher end of the range because, frankly, that is the path that we're on. Despite everything that we're doing here in California, putting in a cap-and-trade regimen into place and everything else that we're doing to try to display leadership, as they say, you know, and in this area, California can't do this job alone. California is a very tiny fraction of world emissions.
Yeah. Professor Mueller, what do you think? We hear a lot in California. It's become, very popular to talk about the green economy, green jobs, electric cars, hybrid cars.
Well, we can do a lot because we're a wealthy country and a wealthy state. But if we're going to be a leader, we have to do things that can be adopted by the poorer nations such as China and India. So, for example, if we switch to electric cars, quite frankly, that won't work. In China, where the electricity comes from coal, a switch to electric cars would result in more carbon dioxide. I see there are two main directions that we need to show leadership in. One is in energy conservation and energy efficiency. There's an enormous amount that can be gained there. This is win-win. I like to think that if it's not profitable, it's not sustainable. Because China has to adopt this. And if it's in their economic interest to adopt it, they will. The other thing we have to do is switch from the coal to the natural gas economy. Just because wind and solar are not going to come around and be cheap enough for China and India to adopt on a large scale. Last year, China introduced a gigawatt of solar. But in fact, that's 1/8 of a gigawatt because the average over day and night is much, much less. And they introduced 40 gigawatts of coal. So we have to somehow show a leadership on how we can help them switch from coal to natural gas.
But, of course, that means some tough political decisions. I mean, Barack Obama's, all in favor of all of the above. That's his policy. You know, nuclear, coal, natural gas, all those things.
Well, I think we have an opportunity here because China has a huge amount of natural gas. Right now, many environmentalists have simply said no more fossil fuels, and so they oppose fracking. And they point out that fracking has been dirty in the past. We need to go to clean fracking. We need to share our technology with China in such a way that we can – this is a humanitarian thing to do. Their citizens are being choked by the coal. This is a switch that they can do that's profitable and something can be done in the next 20 years.
All right. Let's go to the phones now. And our first stop, ironically, is in Texas. Tony from Troy, Texas. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Professor Mueller, I'd like to thank you for publishing your work online. I look forward to reading those papers. I'm a high school science teacher, and when we talk about climate, I always stress paleoclimatology to look at what the climate's been like in the past. And I tell my students that Earth has been warmer in the past. But at this point, I talk about how the climate has, or the temperature has increased by 1 degree Celsius in the last 100 years. And every year I get a student that says, oh, well, that's nothing. That doesn't seem like a lot. But when you look at paleoclimatology, you actually see that that's a really fast rate. And so I wondered if you could comment on that and ask if you agree that it's the rate that we should be emphasizing versus just that the climate is changing. Climate changes and has all over.
Tony, you're right on. Absolutely right. And it's not just the rate. It's that the 1 degree change is roughly what we expect. We know it's from the carbon dioxide now. At least that's the conclusion I reached. And so the danger is not that we're warmer than we've ever been before. In fact, I think we're probably not warmer than we were 1,000 years ago. I have studied paleoclimate for 10 years. I wrote a book on the subject, many, many published papers. The rate at which we are changing climate now, if the carbon dioxide continues to increase, will be unprecedented. It'll be the warmest it's been within the realm of Homo sapiens. So the fact one shouldn't overemphasize it's wrong, I think, to try to scare people based on how much harm has been done so far. No, Kilimanjaro is not melting due to carbon dioxide. The problem is in the future, and at the rate that we see carbon dioxide going up, we're expecting not 1 degree Celsius, but 2-3 degrees Celsius within our lifetimes, and that is scary.
Tony, I'm just curious. Texas does have a different approach politically to climate change than California does. Do you get any pushback in the classroom from, you know, school boards of the school boards or education officials?
No, not from my administration at all. I have a very supportive administration. I'm very thankful for that. I do see the opinions of my students, and I think, and I teach 8th, 10th, and 12th grade, and I feel like I can see some of the political things that they hear and in the news, and that is very hard to overcome in the class. So I try to just show them the paleoclimatology data and allow them to come to their own conclusion. And it's kind of hard to miss that when you see these graphs of especially how it's changed the levels of certain greenhouse gases over the last 150 years. And I think once they can visually see that, I think they start to realize that it's something we need to be concerned of because, again, it's this rate.
Yeah.
That has changed that we're concerned about.
Professor Miller?
Yeah, Tony, you can take some pride in the fact that Texas has been in the leadership of developing natural gas. Here's a number you can teach your students, that for the same energy output, natural gas produces one-third of the carbon dioxide of coal. And much of that development work has taken place in Texas. Texas can be proud of their leadership.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go now to Berkeley. And Mark is on the line. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. I remember seeing Al Gore's famous video presentation of the ice cores of the last 650,000 years showing the rise and fall of carbon dioxide, and then he overlays that with the temperature rising and falling, and he makes the conclusion that the carbon dioxide is causing it. But I always find it hard to distinguish between a correlation between the two and which one is causing which. So in your most recent work, what is it that convinced you that of the causation between carbon dioxide rising and temperature rising?
Good question.
Okay, I recommend you watch that movie again. You will see that Vice President Al Gore never says the carbon dioxide is causing the change. I think he knows very well it wasn't. It lags by about 800 years. So the warming waters emit carbon dioxide. He actually just says they're correlated, and he points to that. And he suggests indirectly that they're one is causing, but he never says that. I think he knows better than that. What's happened in the last 250 years is that the increase in carbon dioxide we know is coming from humans. We can tell this from the isotopes. It's coming from fossil fuels, not from other things. It's not coming from the oceans because that would have more carbon-14 in it. So we know that's where it's coming from, and therefore it is, in fact, driving the climate, not the other way around. That's a change over the paleoclimate data.
All right, Mark, thanks for the call. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. Craig, did you want to say something?
Nope, I'm good.
Oh, okay, fine.
I'm outclassed here.
No. Let's go back to the phones then. And this next stop is Alto, New Mexico. Another Tony on the line. Tony, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for this program. I wanted to follow up on the first caller's question. She emphasizes that the rate is what we should consider. Another aspect of it is that the system has enormous inertia in it, and to change things, it takes a lot of time. I wonder if Dr. Mueller could comment on that.
Yes, it does take time, although I think many of the numbers that have been presented in the popular press are somewhat exaggerated. When we dump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, we have very good statistics on that. We know how much fossil fuels are being mined and how much is being burned. Only half of it shows up in the atmosphere. The rest of it is absorbed into the oceans and also into the landmass. So the time constant for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is actually only a couple of decades. The key thing is if we keep on – right now, the amount of – carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is enough to cause less than 1 degree Celsius of warming. That's really not so bad. The key is to keep it down in the future. We don't have to drop drop the amount in the atmosphere. That will take decades. But I think we want to keep the future emissions as low as possible.
Craig?
Might be a good chance to point out that, of course, all of that carbon dioxide that's going into the oceans presents its own list of problems as well, like the acidification of the oceans.
Damage to reefs.
The damage to reefs and the loss of critical parts of the food chain.
Yeah. All right. Mark or Tony, does that respond to your question?
Yeah, I had one other question for Dr. Mueller.
Yeah, go ahead.
That is, his conversion came as a result of data and statistics, which is most appropriate. But apparently didn't put much credence in the sort of theoretical view of the Apollo 13 view of the Earth in a vacuum, like a thermos, where only heat transfer is radiative heat transfer. Why did the modeling not convince you, sir?
I know the modeling quite well. The issue was not whether carbon dioxide by itself would cause warming, but whether there would be negative and positive feedbacks. The model includes a positive feedback, that is, a little bit of warming leads to more water vapor, which causes more warming. There's also a negative feedback, that a little bit of warming leads to more water vapor, which leads to clouds that reflect sunlight. What was unknown is how much these things contribute. Do they contribute enough that there would be no warming, or do they contribute enough that they account for all the warming? That was the uncertainty.
All right, Tony, thanks so much for the call. Professor Mueller, getting back to Al Gore for a moment, do you think has anything that you've – any of the conclusions you've come to in the last few months, has it changed your view of Al Gore, or do you feel that what is your view of Al Gore?
Well, my prior book, The Physics for Future Presidents, goes through An Inconvenient Truth, in detail, and points out where his mistakes were, where his exaggerations were, where he was misleading. I stand by what I wrote in that book, some of it in my new book. I also go over that again. No, that's all exaggeration and misleading statements. I believe he is genuinely concerned about climate change, and he simply needed to have compelling visual, emotional evidence that would get people on his side. And so he used what politicians use. He uses innuendos, a little bit of exaggeration, and examples that actually are not scientifically sound.
Craig, as you said, there is going to be a poll coming out from the Public Policy Institute of California later today on all this. But you really don't hear much about this at all from either President Obama or Mitt Romney. And people don't really – I mean, it's not really high on people's priorities list, understandable given the economy right now. But what's your take on the politics of this and how it's changed, if it's changed, since 2008?
I don't know that the needle has moved that much since 2008. Since 2006, yes. When Governor Schwarzenegger had his first Governor's Climate Conference, you might recall that then President-elect Obama had this big presentation on this appearance on video when he said, we're going to be the climate presidency, the climate administration. Well, since then, the word has pretty much vanished from his vocabulary. He used it once in his most recent State of the Union address, not at all in the first one, and only in the context of saying it doesn't look like we're going to be doing much about this on the national level.
In the next four years, no matter who's elected,
I guess.
Right.
I think there are two aspects to this. One is that an inconvenient truth, now people know the facts have come out, they know they were fooled, and people resent that. And unfortunately, there's too much backlash. The second one is that now that by the end of this year, China will be producing twice the greenhouse gases of the U.S. If any politician raises the issue that we should sacrifice, there's this rejoinder. Well, what about China? Any policy has to address China, or it's simply not addressing the issue.
Well, how does our policy influence China?
Well, right now it doesn't.
But how can it?
Well, I would like to see the United States share our clean fracking technology with China, that we expedite their shift from coal to natural gas. I've been to China recently. They would love to do this, but it's going to require a U.S. government policy and encouraging of doing this so that they can make that rapid shift.
They're getting into electric cars in a big way, aren't they, or at least the manufacture of batteries?
Well, they yes, they are. But as I pointed out earlier, electric cars isn't good news, not in China, not if your energy is coming from coal.
All right,
and I could just throw in here, too, as a caveat that while Congress has certainly been reluctant to enact any sort of meaningful policy, national policy to deal with climate, there have been some strides, like increasing the fleet efficiency standard of vehicles to eventually 54 miles per gallon. That's a huge step. And so it's not like nothing has been done, But they managed to have to do all these things without talking about climate.
Yeah, and the CAFE standards are really for you know, General Motors has adopted, and I think Ford, much tougher mileage standards.
Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem here is that the public, unfortunately, associates energy conservation with discomfort or sacrifice. In fact, it's highly profitable, as I point out in my new book. You can make money at a higher rate of return than you would have gotten from Bernie Madoff if you were legitimate. Conservation is really a good investment, and that's something that the public doesn't appreciate. Politicians are a little bit leery about, but it really is a direction we can go in the future that will be enormously important and will set a good example for China and India.
Although I don't think we'll see Barack Obama from the Oval Office in a cardigan sweater anytime soon.
No.
No, I hope not. I think that cardigan
sweater... He doesn't look good in cardigan.
That cardigan sweater did enormous damage to the motion for conservation.
For our younger listeners, we're talking about Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
what it said was... to do good for conservation, lower the thermostat, be uncomfortable in your house and put on a sweater. It's for the good. No. You shouldn't have put the insulation on your body. Put it in the walls, and then you save energy.
And put the solar panels back on the White House.
Right. Let's see, some email here. One of the greatest climate change-related risks in California will be increased probability of earthquakes. This will be due to global ice water load shifting from melting ice caps. The global plate tectonic arrangement is a metastable system, which is highly sensitive to significant shifts in loading. We can expect worldwide increases in seismic activity as polar ice melts and the water are redistributed over the world's oceans. Any thoughts about that, Professor?
You're looking at the wrong guy. There are definitely threats to the Delta's integrity from earthquakes, and that can be an issue for California's water future. But I'm going to defer to the physicist on the rest of that.
I don't know who wrote this. There's no author's name here.
There's enormous speculation in these fields. And, I mean, people, just a few years ago, people were speculating that the hurricanes were going up. And, you know, now we know they're actually level or going down. The tornadoes were going up. The wildfires were going up. The reports indicate that maybe variability will go up. And then they report that as variability is going up. This is highly speculative, and I think the shift in the ice from this kind of thing is tiny compared to the shifts we get just from El Nino and changes in the Atlantic Gulf Stream.
Although there is, isn't there, Craig, some correlation between geothermal energy and potential increase in seismic activity?
Yes, I mean to the extent that you use geothermal, you know, as a lever, you know, to get to lower carbon energy, you know, it can increase the risk of earthquakes. Where you're, but geothermal is such a tiny fraction now of all the energy produced, and I don't think it's going to get that big that soon.
Yeah. Another email from Bill in Oakland who writes, any fractional decrease in carbon dioxide production is in response to global warming will easily be offset by exponential population increase. Combating greenhouse gas production directly is hopeless in the face of population increase. Any disagreement with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, population, it's not emissions per person that we're talking about. If that were the case, then a population increase would offset it. We're talking about total emissions. And the U.S. over the last several years has been going down, largely because we've been switching to natural gas. We're talking here about, with a little bit of energy conservation, and mm-hmm. with just 3% per year, we could have the entire world living at the current European standard of living by the end of the century, and yet using less energy than we're using today.
Craig?
Well, I agree. The issue is not per capita, but I mean, you'd have to agree, wouldn't you, that total emissions is, to some degree, a function of total population. More people burning more fuels, doing more stuff, buying more stuff, that creates emissions, right?
That does, because we're not conserving enough. But the conservation can offset that, and a big change from coal can have a huge effect compared to the population increase.
All right, let's see another email here from Claire, who writes, I think your listeners would be interested to know about our recently released program, RISE, Climate Change in Coastal Communities. RISE tells stories about people living around the San Francisco Bay and El Viso, Foster City, the Delta, the Financial District, who are dealing with the question mm-hmm. Of how we might adapt to sea level rise and extreme weather due to climate change. And Craig, that was the topic of one of those, or if not both of those reports yesterday, wasn't it?
Yeah. RISE was a three-part documentary that we aired here on KQED, an independently produced documentary on what sea level rise might look like in the Bay Area. Recently won an award from the Society of Environmental Journalists.
All right, let's go to the phones. Again, that number, 866-733-6786. And Liza in San Jose, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead. You're on.
Well, speaking of sea level rise, provides, which you just touched on. I work with a lot of cities and counties in the Bay Area, and a lot of folks are starting to look at what sort of infrastructure projects they can do to protect against sea level rise, things like flood walls and levees. But if you look at these curves, they're exponential. You could build a levee to protect yourself from sea level rise in 2050, and it would be overtopped by 2070. So I wonder if your guest can comment on what is the practicality of infrastructure projects to protect against sea level rise. And also, I've often wondered, all the curves stop at 2100. Is there a practical limit to sea level rise? I mean, that exponential curve can't go on forever, can it?
I'll defer on the practical limit part of the question, but I'll address the first part, which is I think that most of the effort toward adaptation to sea level rise is not about building bigger defenses in California. It's about this idea of managed retreat. It's planners asking the question, okay, at what point are we going to have to pick up our sewage treatment plant and move it back because it's going to be inundated? Those are the kind of questions they're asking, I think, more than what, you know, our. But some places will have to be levied and sea-walled. And,
you know, go ahead, yeah, Liza?
I was going to say I agree with you, but I can tell you that is the last thing that public works directors want to hear right now. The idea of abandonment is not a popular one because they don't want to turn around and have to tell their residents, look, you're going to have to leave your property. I mean, I agree with you from a practical standpoint, but I don't think that cities and counties are ready to hear that or at least ready to sign on to that quite yet.
Professor Mullen?
Yeah, I've been contacted by quite a few people about this issue, and most people who are panicked about this get their panic from seeing an inconvenient truth and the 100 feet of sea level rise. Keep in mind that the recent prediction is by 2050, 16 inches. That is not as much as many people imagine when they go through this panic. About your question about the limit, about half of the sea level rise comes from the warming of the oceans. Things that are warmed expand. And so in that sense, no, there's no limit to this. But keep in mind, it's not as much as many people think it is.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. You know, Craig, as you were talking, I was thinking about this new 49ers ballpark that's planned down in Santa Clara, which I think is on the base. Is it on the base? It's on the base side of the freeway.
Not my beat.
Not your beat, I know, but it does make me wonder if they're thinking about that because that's it's very close to the base.
Well, they should be thinking about that. In fact, there's a rule in place in California, now that planners have to think about that when they think about building anything. And in fact, there's been a lot of friction about a planned new community down in the former salt harvesting ponds, Redwood City, that Cargill has been wanting to build out a huge brand new community right on the bay down there. And there's been a lot of pushback against that. And because to do that, you would have to build enormous levees to protect that community.
Yeah, and of course, and as you rule out development closer to the bay, it costs developers a lot of money, potentially, too.
That's right. This is prime real estate. Everybody wants to be near the water, and that's going to be a problem.
Today they do, anyway.
Well, yeah.
How near do they want to be is the question, right. I guess. All right, let's try to sneak in another call or two here. Holly in San Francisco, good morning.
Yes, thank you for this program. I was wondering if the speaker could address whether when he's talking about carbon dioxide as the human effect on the climate from carbon dioxide, if he's using that as a proxy for all greenhouse gases, or if he's specifically referring to carbon dioxide. I know it's the most abundant in the atmosphere and it stays up there for a long time, but there are other things like methane and all that create more warming, and we haven't talked about any of the things that we can do to reduce other greenhouse gases.
Yeah, Holly, you're exactly right. You're using the technical term. We use it as a proxy. We have put in methane. It doesn't change the results at all. The more things you put in, the better the fit will always get. The key thing here is that with simply using that carbon dioxide proxy, and the methane is roughly proportional to that, we get such a good fit that it keeps the argument simple and clean. But yes, we do include methane.
All right, thanks. Yeah, Craig?
Some have advanced the argument, Dr. Mueller, that we should be focusing more on methane and other greenhouse gases that they don't last as long in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide, but while they're there, are much more potent warming gases. What do you think about that?
No, that's exactly right. Methane given its short lifetime, is still the estimate, most recent estimate I saw was 23 times more potent than carbon dioxide, and it's contributing about one quarter of the warming. I think the issue is in the future, again, we don't have much warming yet. In the future, we expect a great deal of warming, largely from the coal plants of the developing world. If they also switch to having a lot of cattle and other things that make methane, then that's a danger too. But right now, I see the coming rise as being primarily in carbon dioxide.
All right, Holly, thanks for the call. A couple emails here. Jason in Oakland, this is for you, Professor. Why does Richard Mueller suddenly think we should applaud him? Most of the other scientists who are serious have been knowing this for years. Although I have to say, I don't think you've been asking for people to applaud you.
Certainly not. People who have known this for years, I typically ask them questions, what about the station quality? How do you ignore that? And the answer I get from people who have known the answer for years is, oh, what are you talking about? I've never heard about that. And then I explain it to them. And I say, what about data selection, the fact that they've taken long-term stations that were once out in the countryside and now in the middle of the cities? How do you discount that? And their reaction is, oh, I didn't know about that. So I think one can have beliefs based on what you know about, but my agnosticism was based on knowledge of things that needed to be addressed, and we have addressed them now. And I don't want people to applaud me. I want them to read our papers
and
that
are
posted online. And buy the book.
The book, by the way, is called Energy for Future Presidents, Richard Mueller, Professor of Physics from UC Berkeley. Thanks so much for being here this hour. And thanks also to Craig Miller. He's senior editor of KQED's Climate Watch. And by the way, Craig's most recent article and the op-ed piece from Richard Mueller can be found at our website. It's kqed.org/forum. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Amy Machado, and Vinnie Tong. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. And our executive producer is Rob Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.